This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and apparently all over the world, including South America, people who access the show over the internet. We have three studio guests this week, Terry Clement and Tim Elliott. Tim Elliott is from Amnesty International, and he's going to talk about the recent execution of a British man in China for drug smuggling. Terry Clements is here to speak on a feature about drug abuse and how we can support them. That's in tune with a feature from Johnny Royden. We have features from Anthony Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Greaves reads another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.L. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. Trevor Carter, the resident bard, our bard of Windmill Hill, reads his latest poem. And Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. And we also hear from the Zeitgeist Movement later on. What's that? Stay around to find out. I'm John Peters Coleman. According to a national poll commissioned last year, substance abuse affects one in five of us. That's over 60,000 people here in Bristol today who are affected by drugs or alcohol. Class A drug use creates around £15 billion in crime and health costs each year. Between a third and a half of all robberies, burglaries and other thefts are related to drug abuse, and that will probably come as no surprise, 99% of which are caused by problematic drug users, usually involving heroin or crack cocaine. Places like the Bristol Drugs Project and other drug services have been working hard to bring these figures down, and despite all the scare stories, they have been successful so far, with each year showing progressively lower figures of actual crime and health costs. Like so many sectors, however, drug treatment is facing a number of cuts due to take place at the end of April. Over £500,000 has been announced so far to be cut from the pooled treatment budget, a fund that is used to provide money for all drug treatment agencies, and this figure works out to be around 8% of the total money usually distributed throughout Bristol. On top of that, all services will get a 0% uplift this year. Uplift is the increase in funds that is given in line with inflation and is estimated to cause around £65,000 of additional costs for the Bristol Drugs Project, which is effectively a further cut. The NHS also contributes a great deal towards drug treatment, and the health budget for 2010-2011 is yet to be announced, but we're assuming that cuts are going to be expected there as well. Services from these agencies will therefore be reduced, leaving few alternatives for suffering addicts. But there is, of course, prison. This next feature by Johnny Royden explores the subject.
My name is Colin. I got into heroin and crack. Got into when I was about 16. A lot of my friends were doing it. And an older person introduced me to it, knowing that it was so addictive that I'd be able to support him with it. So I got into crack. But I'm about 22, 23. And I've been in prison for about 3 years. It was a big thing in prison. Everyone was doing it around me, and I was pretty down at the time. So I tried heroin for the first time, and I really liked it. At first, you really do like it, especially in prison. I didn't see no problem with taking it. I just didn't realise the consequences or how it would get a grip of me.
My name's Sarah Wilson. My job is counselling coordinator. When they brought in mandatory drug testing, people were switching from using cannabis to using heroin because cannabis stays in their system for a lot longer than heroin. So people were actively making that switch in prison and then getting a habit.
My name is Richie MacDonald, and I'm a group worker on the structured daycare programme at the Bristol Drugs Project. I'm quite clear that people who are addicted to drugs and drink, they go to prison, and there's a cessation in the battle. You know, they lay down arms for a while, but the war's not over. When they are released from prison, unless their addiction has been treated, they do what they've always done. Nothing's been addressed. A lot of guys that I work with, that I see, they can't stop. They haven't got a belief in themselves that they can stop. They're in a cycle, and part of that cycle can include drug using on the street, going to prison, being maintained on high doses of methadone without a psychosocial treatment, and coming out of prison pretty much in the same situation as when they went in psychologically, very quickly picking up drugs and going back to the same situation, the same behaviours as they were when they were last on the street. Prison is definitely not the answer to that.
I'm Brian and I'm a group worker at BDP. You know, because they're so linked, crime and drugs, and we're not dealing with criminals, we're dealing with people that have problems with drugs. The problem is drugs, the problem is not the crime. So if you address the drug problem and give support to people and help them to move away from that, then the crime's going to lessen.
My name's Duncan Shaw and I'm a group worker at Bristol Drugs Project.
Most of our work is actually bringing them back into the community. And this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to bring the community to them, because it's such a difficult thing for people when they feel totally ostracised from the rest of society. And I think that's unnecessary. I think we need to get more human about this.
OK, I'm Maggie Telfer and I'm the Chief Executive at Bristol Drugs Project. The links between drug treatment and, you know, so-called acquisitive crime, burglary, shoplifting, other kind of ways of raising money is very strong and proven. If you look on the Home Office website, it very clearly states that for every pound we spend on drug treatment, we save £9.50 on costs to kind of wider society. If people are out there, they have a problem with drugs like heroin or crack cocaine, they're getting their money from somewhere. And if you provide people with drug treatment, then those kind of acquisitive crimes go down.
Just watching people get their lives back and get meaning in their lives, and to be able to sit and say, yeah, my life's really good and I'm doing this and I'm doing that and I'm doing this and I'm thinking about that and I might go there, that's really important to hang on to.
Drug treatment does work. Over the years, it's been more emphasised, drug treatment in the community as opposed to residential. And I see that really kind of working, because, you know, we're working with individuals in their environment to change their environment. So everybody's involved in community drug treatment, and we should be. And, you know, most people actually want to be. It does work, and it is working.
£9.50 saved from the criminal justice system and other areas for every £1 spent on treatment. And that's quite a significant figure. If you or someone you know has problems with drugs or alcohol and you need help or support, you can call the Narcotics Anonymous Helpline, which is free from most places. And the number for that is 0300 999 1212. So that's 0300 999 1212. Well, I'd like to introduce to the studio Terry Clements. Hello.
Hello, nice to meet you as well. Nice to get on a show and talk about some of these issues which you just mentioned.
So tell us a little bit about yourself in relation to BCFM.
In relation to BCFM, I do a radio recovery show. It's coming up to its third year at the moment, and I do that because I really passionately believe that people should be given more options and more help and more information on how to change their lives, especially when they're entrenched in you know, long-time drug use.
So we heard a little bit about, in that feature, how people get into drugs. How do you feel, having interviewed a lot of people with drug problems, that people are getting supported currently?
Well, there's different support agencies out there. There is lots of support, but I just think that this is just massive. You know, you're just seeing, like, the tip of the iceberg in the people who are coming into the services. There's so many people too shamed to actually come into services. You know, women with children, they find it really difficult to come into services because of a social service involvement, and their children might be at risk of being taken away from them.
Right. I mean, you would have thought, you know, for every £1 spent, £9.50 saved. I mean, that's a pretty good catch bite, a soundbite to try and get the attention of policymakers. Is that message not getting through then?
Well, I just think, you know, big business is big business. Like, look at the alcohol business, and they're even saying, like, you know, the price of alcohol at the moment is just so cheap. They're actually, you know, manufacturing alcoholics. There's 1.4, I think there's 1.5 reported emergency cases every minute. There's someone going in with an alcohol-related incident into the hospitals. And if they did cut, you know, the unit price per alcohol, they would half the amount of people going into the accident and emergency on a daily basis. I mean, did they want to do something about that?
How do you think we should get the message through to people who are making decisions, and what exactly should, you know?
I just think that, you know, basically you just, it's, you know, you need a bit of power in what in the way you're approaching this. I think everyone's a bit too laid back around what's really going on. You talk about wars in other countries, and there's a war going on, right? You know, our children our parents, our brothers and sisters, you know, our family and our communities, they're getting eroded and destroyed.
Do you think because of the 60s counterculture, being against drugs is a little bit square?
Yeah, of course it can be seen as being square.
You think
definitely.
Because the establishment are of the age where, you know, they're born back in the 50s or whatever. Do you think there's maybe a legacy of that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of people want to go out and have a good time, and they want some alcohol and they want drugs, you know, and they want to have a good time, and that's what party's all about. We're brought up in a culture of let's party. But for some people, it's not a joke. The party's finished at some point and they become addicted to drugs, and that is not partying. You know, that is really a horrible existence for people when they become addicted to drugs and become slaves to drug dealers. That's not partying. So it crosses a line at some point, you know, and for a lot of people, it never crosses that line.
So if somebody's out there listening to them and they are engaging in what we heard referred to as acquisitive crimes, what do you find from speaking to drug addicts? It seems to be the best way to mentally get yourself out of that cycle.
Well, it's a combination, you know, it's not just one thing. It's a lot of people, you take the drugs away from people and they've still got the behaviours. The behaviours have been built up, you know, and there is an excitement in committing crime and doing things wrong. Like you just said, the counterculture. And myself, I've got a criminal history and I got a buzz out doing things wrong. You know, so that is another kind of high, just like the drugs. So you're going to have to treat, you know, the offending behaviour as well, and he's treating, not just treating people coming off of drugs. You need to start looking at why people are wanting to do appropriate acts in communities and societies.
So what have you changed your inappropriate behaviours with to get you high?
Well, appropriate behaviours. You know, I've got more into creative endeavours, you know, music, learning how to be a bit of a more decent person in the community. You know, that's the only change that I know.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about more when the show is on and when people can sort of hear a little bit about, you know, if people have been touched by the subject.
I interview people who have gone through recovery processes and managed to turn their lives around. And that show is on a Sunday, 11 till 12. And people can hear true life experiences of people who've managed to turn their lives around.
Cool. Well, there you go. If you listen to that and you've got a drug problem, there is hope. And just a reminder, the Narcotics Anonymous helpline, even if you're not sure exactly what you're going to say, ring them anyway. 0300 999 1212. And Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm going to chat to Tim Elliott now. He's the chair of the Amnesty Bristol branch, and we're going to chat about the British man who was executed in China recently for drug smuggling. You may have heard this on the radio. Hello, Tim.
Hi, John. Good to be here again.
Yeah, nice to welcome you again.
Yeah, thank you.
How has Amnesty International been involved precisely in that story?
Trying to campaign as much as possible, raise awareness. We had some actions go out to all our members across the UK, an urgent action asking all of our members to email and send letters to Gordon Brown and the Foreign Secretary to make sure that this issue is, you know, raised as much as possible with the Chinese government.
Okay, so I mean, you've engaged in sort of responsive action from what you've heard, but how far back in time did you first hear about it?
Probably when he was first arrested, about 2 years ago.
Okay.
Just over, actually, in about 2007.
Yeah.
He was arrested on a flight out of Turkmenistan, I believe, and he had a few kilograms of heroin on him. Chinese authorities found this. He was arrested for drug smuggling and went through the sort of Chinese judicial system there. So we sort of found out about it then, really, and that was when these concerns about his mental health started to arise.
Right. So what did he think he was doing going into China from Turkmenistan with lots of heroin?
Well, there's, you know, his family and he have said that he was unaware that the drugs were in this case, that he was tricked into taking it across the border. Mm. He was actually, I mean, it seems like he might have suffered from a mental health breakdown in the UK.
Yeah.
He sort of left his family. He was a father of three, used to live in London, and he thought that he was going to China to find his, you know, career as a singer, I believe, and it's strange story.
Yes, yeah. I heard a report from a teacher who met him whilst he was in Eastern Europe in Prague somewhere a few months earlier, and this chap believed that he'd written an amazing song that was going to bring peace around the world.
Oh, that's right,
and he's going to travel around the world, you know, sort of spreading his word. I mean, is it likely that China is going to sort of recognise a mental health issue, seeing as they do have a fairly atrocious sort of human rights record generally? I mean
it is unlikely that they would recognise mental health issue, absolutely, and probably one of the reasons why they didn't want to investigate his mental health further and they didn't sort of bend to international pressure was that probably the majority of people executed in China do have some mental health issues, and it's probably, you know, Terry was talking about tip of the iceberg earlier, and this really is a tip of the iceberg in terms of sort of China's, you know, system,
where
it's likely that a lot of people have got mental health issues, and they did not want this to be uncovered, and it probably would have snowballed into a lot more than it was.
Do you ever feel frustrated? I mean, the media often only seem to cotton onto this until it's sort of too late. I mean, you know, you only hear about it 2 days before. Doesn't really give the public much of a chance to get a mass movement going, really, does it?
No, I mean, that's true. I mean we have heard about this case for quite a while now, probably, you know, a couple of years. But in China, usually the sort of way people are executed is they only find out the morning they are executed.
Right.
And the Chinese government have said that, you know, actually in this case they did actually put special. It was a special circumstance, and they told him 4 days before, and they allowed family to come over from England and see him before he was executed.
Okay.
And the Chinese government is saying that they did things by the book, and it wasn't necessarily a special case. But you know, in terms of getting the public involved, it's it is frustrating, and you know, but it could have been that he was reprieved. So
to give the, you know, some sort of sense of hope, I mean, presumably there must be other similar cases all over the world at any one point in time. I mean, what sort of cases, you know, have you got where it has been successful and you've actually, you know, you've got a campaign to write off to Gordon Brown and, you know, sort of some change has been effected? Or
yeah, I mean, there's numerous cases that Amnesty have campaigned for where people actually have been taken on off the death penalty, off the system in China, and one sort of system, a case a couple of years ago, and it turns out that the person he was supposed to have executed, his wife, was actually still alive. So it was very, very lucky that we campaigned in that particular case.
Okay, so there's a mixture of good stories and bad. Obviously, he unfortunately passed away and by lethal injection. What other sort of things have you got going on at the moment? What are your major preoccupations for Amnesty International right now?
For Amnesty, we've got a new campaign being launched last year called Demand Dignity. It's all about economic, social and cultural rights, and looking at things like corporate social responsibility, maternal rights and
Where can people find out more?
You can find out more on the Amnesty website, www.amnesty.org.uk, and you can get in contact with us at the Bristol Group at bristolgroup@amnesty.org.uk.
Well, at that juncture, I'd like to introduce Terry Clements earlier on back into the conversation. What would you like to say in response to that?
Well, in response to that, I just think the whole area of mental health and drug addiction, drug use, dual diagnosis, as they call it today, is massive. And there's so many undiagnosed cases out there, and people just getting rough treatments because they're not getting the diagnosis around the mental health. They're just focusing on the crime of what they've done with drugs.
Mm. I mean, how do you feel about the situation in China? Obviously, you know, first-hand experience here, and you know, knowing that that could happen in a country like China, and with, you know, if that happens here with the people you know, how would you, you know, feel?
It's just a highlighted example. I can see different different scenarios in this country, things happening where people are getting have been executed by a serious, you know, flying squads, drug users who've gone out on robberies and been shot on the pavements.
Yeah.
I don't see no difference in this guy getting executed over there. I think that, you know, there's a bad kind of law for some people.
Yeah, and I mean, it's under international law that, you know, nobody should be executed for a non-violent sort of crime anyway, and that's sort of the way it is, really. And just, I mean, the way people do get executed for drug-related crimes is, Amnesty's view is absolutely shocking. But, you know, China's point of view is, you know, a lot of comments have come back from Chinese government and people in China saying, look, well, do you support the drugs trade? Do you, you know, and what about, you know, 100 years ago when Britain was, you know, ruling sort of the opium trade in sort of South, you know, East China Seas, and they seem a bit sort of contradictory, where we're trying to sort of not trying to limit the drugs trade in this way. But it just seems pretty heavy hand, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is heavy handed. It's control from a government. Maybe they don't want, you know, to send a weak message out to the people in Europe that or other people that it's okay to come to their country with drugs, and start poisoning their people.
Okay, well, at that point, I'm afraid I've got to draw that to a close because we're going to run out of time for that one. But thank you both for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
It's almost a decade since the 9/11 attack took place that shook the world. Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's two interviews with people from Bristol who were actually in the States when the attacks took place. Afterwards, I'll be talking to a member of the Zeitgeist Movement Group about 9/11.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. Two planes crashed into the twin towers of the World Trade Center in New York this morning, about 20 to 30 minutes apart. Black smoke has been pouring out of huge holes in the upper portions of the building.
My name is Eva.
And where did we meet?
We met in Asda Bedminster.
And you're from Latvia?
I am from Latvia.
Can you tell us how you came to be in New York?
Right after high school, I went to U.S. to be an au pair for an American family in New York.
And you were there when the Twin Towers collapsed?
Yeah, I was there.
What happened?
What I remember, we were just sitting. I wasn't in Manhattan, but I was pretty close. 30 minutes drive away, or, you know, you could walk. And we were just sitting home. It was like early morning, 9 or 10 something in the morning. And everybody was just calling, switch on TV, because at the first moment it felt unreal, because you're seeing on the TV that something has hit the one twin tower, and it's all in flames and fire, and then everything is, you know, everybody's panicking.
So were there children in the house watching this?
Yeah, but the smallest one, she was like 2 years old, so she didn't really see it, because the two eldest one were in school. Yeah, they didn't see it. They just heard it afterwards.
So were the parents in the house?
No, I was alone with my other friend who was an au pair for another family.
Was there any reaction in the street or from other people? Were people ringing each other?
Not really. I mean, I wasn't on the street. I didn't run out the street, but everybody was just calling on the phone. My mom tried me to reach me and really was worried because she couldn't, because all of the phone lines were kind of blocked. Everybody was trying to ring everybody, and it was just blocked.
So did you see any of the smoke from the house?
No, not really. No, but I could feel, like, a few hours later, I could feel the really bad smell. It's really bad. I'm still thinking of how could I describe it, but it was really bad smell.
What was it, burning smell or...?
Very intense.
Like acrid?
Maybe, yeah, because, you know, all those concretes are burning and, you know, a lot of techniques have been burned and so on. And a few weeks later, it was just about time for me to leave the family, and I wanted to move to actually a Manhattan area to find a job. And then it was just the weird feeling wandering around the streets. You actually see the ground zero. And it's there. It's not from the movies. It's for real. And all the streets are packed with cards, sympathies, and so on. And it's what amazed me the most, the big New York that never sleeps. It's just empty. A lot of the cafes or bars, it's just not closed, but it's the doors are sealed because it's closed ground zero. But it was just dead. The New York was dead.
How long did the smell last for?
It was for a few weeks.
Do you still think about it?
I still think about it, yeah. It's not just me. I was reading in the news, because everybody knows in the world, but I was there, and I actually saw it, and later I moved in Manhattan, like Manhattan, October, something like that. I lived pretty close to Ground Zero, so when I had a day off from work, I just went to see what's new, what have... Because there were a lot of firefighters working, clearing it off. And, yeah, it was just a weird feeling to walk by and just imagine that the world's tallest buildings have collapsed and so many people have died.
My name is Jackie Franklin.
Can you tell us about what happened during the 9/11?
We were on holiday in Disney and we were at the Animal Resort, and we woke up on this particular morning and we turned the television on, and as everyone remembers the images of the towers, we saw this and we actually thought it was a film. And we flicked from one to the other and it was on the same channel, and I jokingly said to my husband, oh, this is an Orson Welles War of the Worlds, you know, someone's having a laugh. And then the awful realisation dawned that this was actually happening at that point, and we were on holiday trying to have a good time, and suddenly everything that everyone had known, the world had come to an end in certain ways for people. And we got to the point, and I remember the image of the chap jumping from the window, which I know is quite an iconic one for a number of people. And at that point, we turned it off. So we then decided that we'd get out of the hotel, and we jumped on a bus because we're actually on Disney Resorts. The bus driver said, "What's going on?" And we said, "Why do you know?" And she said, "Well, we're not getting any information. We're not being told anything." So we told her the latest situation as we knew it, and we went off to one of the resorts, which was obviously completely empty. There was no one around, and everyone was standing in total stunned silence. They were in little knots and little groups. And we went back to the hotel, and in all of the public areas, they were gathering around a television, there were families, and there was no noise. They were just silent.
Was anyone crying at this point?
I don't think that people knew enough to cry, because they just didn't know how to process it. Something fundamental had happened to their world, to their perception of America and their lives. And the sad thing or the awful thing was everybody was out at the public telephones trying to phone home. And there were loads and loads and loads of people just standing there. And, of course, everything was engaged. So they'd walk back into the cafeteria with the children. And they're trying to engage the children and go and get them to go playing. But the children knew that there was something going on. So, you know, they wouldn't leave Mum, they wouldn't leave Dad. And, of course, you've got these constant images on the television all of the time. And then as the day wore on, we went back to our room and we picked up on some of the news. And we decided we'd go down later on that evening for some dinner. And it was as though nothing had happened in the restaurants. None of the staff would say anything about it. You know, they were laughing and, "How are you? Have a nice day. What did you do today?" And, you know, people just weren't going to be engaged in that. They wanted to talk about it because that's the way that people deal with things. And we actually spoke to one waiter or waitress and said, you know, have you got anybody in New York? Do you know anybody? Do you know what's going on? And they said, yeah, we've got family up there. Yes, we're really worried. No, we haven't, but we're not allowed to talk about it. I said, well, you know, you can talk about it with us. We're not going to say that you've been talking about it. You know, it's just one of those dreadful things. And then as the days wore on, we started to hear of people that were in the hotel that couldn't go home because the flights had been cancelled. Then the stories were coming through of when their friends, their families were involved in it. You know, they got on the last ferry that left Manhattan and they were watching it happening and they actually saw the planes go into the buildings. And so many people were connected to it in a very personal way.
So what happened at the resort? Did they close the resort down or tone it down?
They tried to do business as usual. So they had all the restaurants open, they had all of the events open, but they did shut the parks. Nobody was allowed to go out of the parks. And we were on Disney property, which meant that you couldn't get out because none of the buses were working, no taxis were driving around. So it was almost as though they sort of confined everybody to quarters and it was you know, you weren't allowed out. We felt we were under curfew on a holiday. Yeah, it was very, very bizarre. And then when we left the resorts after they opened them up and we went back, because obviously we were on holiday, we wanted to go, it was just empty. And we moved down to Naples after that, and then we went down to the Keys, and we had the hotels to ourselves. There was nobody there at all, no Americans. They'd all just gone home completely.
So do you ever think about that day?
Oh, yes, very often. Something will trigger it. And I can still see the room. Absolutely everything about that room is in my mind. I know where the bed is, I know what was on the sink in the bathroom, and I remember making coffee, and I still see the television with those images on there.
Well, I'd like to introduce Barbara Ali to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
You're from the Zeitgeist Group. Tell me, how was the Zeitgeist Group inspired by the events of 9/11?
Well, it wasn't actually inspired. I think it goes beyond that. It actually has a root in a lot of things, in the monetary system, the financial system,
yep.
How the fractional reserve system works, mm-hmm. and how money is created out of debt, and it's a continual vicious circle of debt growing.
Okay. Did you feel that 9/11 played some part in, I don't know, your movement has seen it as symptomatic of a lot of the way about the world works, possibly? I mean,
yes, definitely. 9/11 was a huge thing. The whole world got shaken up by that, obviously. The Zeitgeist movement has two documentaries currently. Both are on YouTube and Google,
yeah.
And both are for free to watch. They have a website as well.
Mm-hmm.
The first one goes into a lot of detail about 9/11,
yeah.
And just like Loose Change describes all the ideas about how 9/11 could have been an inside job rather than, you know, the way it is portrayed in the media.
Yeah.
So it does clarify a lot of things and then correlates with other things as well.
Okay. The war on terror and the financial crisis, do you feel that they're therefore connected? This is the connection between, say, 9/11 and problems with the monetary system? And
yeah. The way money is generated is a continual debt. So they need a war in order to keep going with the debt.
Yeah.
So every time they need they have weapons, so they need to use those weapons in order to actually get more weapons so that they can generate more money. Out of the public money, obviously, so they can ask the taxpayers to give them more money.
Yeah.
So okay. It's a continue.
And this is part of what the movie sort of explains.
Yeah, it does link with that, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Around the country, you know, you're sort of trying to get this Zeitgeist movement going. Tell me a little bit about what the movement is. What are you trying to do as a movement?
Currently, the idea is just to raise awareness. As long as there's grassroots level awareness throughout the country and throughout the world, in fact, there will be a tipping point where a lot of people get together and say, no, we don't want this anymore. Mm-hmm. We want a different system. The system is not working.
So so part of the Zeitgeist movement is that you propose a solution to the problems of being trapped in this sort of war economy, financial situation.
Beyond politics, beyond war, beyond religion. Yeah, beyond everything that is a system of control, basically.
Mm-hmm. And the vision is the Venus Project.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Yes. So tell me a bit about what's the solution, what's the Venus Project?
The Venus Project basically is a vision of Jacques Fresco. He is based in Florida. He's 92 years old. He's a self-taught engineer, so he's outside of the mainstream education. So he could think outside of the box, and he's come up with like hundreds of designs of how to create, say, efficient energy vehicles and modular design of living buildings. So you don't have to actually create a building where it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. He proposes we create it in modules and in factories, say, and then they're just transported there where they're needed, and using intelligent materials which are already available, using nanotechnology, using everything that's already there, but the monetary system restricts the use of that.
I mean, we probably have examples of energy-efficient vehicles already anyway. You know, and there's always the caravan, of course, which is a good example of modular living. So how does this connect in with a solution to, you know, having being trapped in the monetary system? How's this going to get us out of it?
Yeah, basically, the monetary system restricts development in the sense that you always need capital to develop anything. Mm-hmm. You always need money. So what ends up happening is there is a brilliant idea,
yeah,
but because there is no capital to be invested in that.
So what do you suggest instead?
We suggest a resource-based economy. The resource-based economy is an economy where there is no money. The first thing is there is no money. So what happens is all the resources of the world, the whole planet, are pooled together.
Yeah.
Different economies still work separately, mm-hmm. but they are all linked together in a network, sort of like an internet.
Yeah.
And the network then efficiently allocates the resources between the economies, wherever they're needed. So if there's a scarcity in one part of the world, that is met by an excess in another part of the world.
Okay, and so what exactly are you doing in Bristol, and how can people get involved?
Basically, in Bristol, we are proposing to do a Z Day on 13th of March, and it will be in Bristol, in central Bristol. And mm-hmm. there will be an event like a rock gig, presentations, and yep. Q&A sessions, and a documentary will be shown.
Brilliant. How can people find out more about and get about it? Involved? We've got a website here, the zeitgeistmovement.com. Will that have all the information?
Yeah, but there is a Bristol portion of that. Go on to zeitgeistmovement.com.
Or the Zeitgeist Movement
UK.com, yes.
As well. There's also a YouTube channel, youtube.com/BristolZM, and the Zeitgeist Movement will be available there for people to watch and find out more.
Well, it's available on YouTube, but not in this particular channel, but certainly it is available. It will be linking to that, certainly.
Okay, brilliant. And if you want to find out more, you can always email them, bzm@live.co.uk. And thank you very much for your time, Baba, for coming in today and giving us a brief insight into your movement.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Bristol is incredibly rich in local history. One of the oldest and best of these is probably the Temple Local History Group, who have produced scores of booklets about different areas and aspects of local history, such as the history of the medieval city and Bristol's newspapers.
I'm Julian Lee Jones, and I'm the chairman and founder of Temple Local History Group, which we founded on May 1980. Nowadays, we're a resource centre and a research group, so we're loosely coupled. But when we started for the first 15, 20 years, we had regular meetings, and we formed by a whole group of engineers, mathematicians, modellers working for a company called Sperry Gyroscope on Temple Back, and Temple Local History Group, because we were working on Temple Back and we wondered what this burnt out church was next to us.
Can you start off by telling us about the medieval conduits, because Bristol's very rich in these conduits. What were they originally built for, and where are they?
They ring all of the monastic houses that ringed Bristol, sort of seven or so monastic houses, the Carmelites, St. James, the Grey Friars, they all needed copious supplies of water. And it was a tradition, a medieval tradition. They persuaded the landowners, the medieval landowners, the feudal landowners, to actually provide them with rights, access rights to springs, which, as Bristol is set down in the valley, the medieval city, they were granted rights of water rising on the springs on the hills surrounding Bristol. St John's Church is the only remaining church over a city wall in Bristol, but St Nicholas and all of the others. And if you go from the High Street just above Bristol Bridge and you go into St Nicholas Street, for example, it curves around, so you're walking clockwise. And if you walk around, you get to Corn Street, you cross over Corn Street, there's a dark entrance of Leonard Lane. If you walk along Leonard Lane, again curving clockwise, you come to your right, you come to the crossing over, and you've got Small Street, and you've got Bell Lane, and you come to Broad Street, and you can work your way right the way around till you come up Tower Lane and the Pitay. You've walked around the medieval city, the inner city walls.
So whereabouts does the water, the fresh water that feeds these conduits, come from?
There's an aquifer, which is a spring water line, geological water line, around about the 120-foot level. And you'll find the springs like at Ashley Down, which fed the Key Pipe, the Pannywell, St John's Conduit, which was, in fact was the Carmelite Friary Pipe, which is where the Colson Hall is now. And they all fed down into, say, these monastic houses. And if we use the Carmelite Friary, everybody knows that was the St John's Conduit. Well, until recent year or so, that had been flowing for 700 years. I mean, even during the last war, World War II, there's a plaque on the conduit outlet at St John's in Nelson Street. You'll see there that it provided the only supply of water for all the inhabitants in the last war.
So these were they private water supplies for the monks, or did the public have access to them?
The monastic houses owned and controlled the supply, or they were granted the supply, so it was their private water supply. However, they did give. I mean, the reason it's called St John's Conduit is because it was a Carmelite's pipe, the Carmelite Friary, and they, in 1200s, middle of the 1200s, and in the 1300s, they gave an extension of their pipe to the parishioners of St John's. And what happened, of course, when the dissolution of the monasteries in the 1500s, then the priory was swept away, and so the only reason for the water outlet then, or the main reason for the water outlet, was it was continued to maintain, to provide the parishioners of St John's, and so it became known as St John's Pipe, St John's Conduit, and it's still known as St John's Conduit, although it was originally the Carmelite Pipe.
That was Julian Lee Jones, coordinator of the Temple Local History Group, and you can find them on the web at www.history4u.info, which is history, the number 4, and the letter U. And we'll be hearing more from Julian Lee Jones next week, and there are booklets in the Bristol Museums and archives for you to find out more as well. Malcolm Greaves reads this week's instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.L. Street, a whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. The Old Order Changeth. Walter Noakes was a shepherd of no mean ability. That means he lived his life primarily for his sheep and had few other interests, for a flock is an exacting mistress. All day long, from dawn to sunset, and in lambing time all night as well, Walter toiled for his sheep, and every evening save Saturday, when work and gardening were done, he sat in his cottage and thought about them. But on Saturday evenings, it was his custom to visit the village inn. Even this small weekly relaxation was not unconnected with his flock's well-being, for the company in the taproom were all engaged in agricultural pursuits, and the conversation invariably centred on the farming problems of the immediate neighbourhood. Shepherds would point out to carters that the sowing of future sheep feed was behindhand, and that they must hurry up, or in a few months' time the sheep would be short of grub. The carters would argue fiercely that they were most hard-worked folk, and could not sit down all the afternoon, minding sheep. Dairymen insisted that they got too little hay for their cows, while the sheep had far too much. Comparisons of the flocks, herds and crops on the local farms would be made, and the respective foibles of the different farmers of the village would be discussed keenly. And so the talk would go, and did go, until the outbreak of the war. From that time until the armistice, the war and farming matters shared honours equally in these debates. When peace was declared, Walter Noakes thought farming would regain its place as the principal topic on Saturday evenings, but to his great disappointment, it lost ground rapidly. Films, boxing, racing, football, and similar subjects were all that the majority of the company seemed to care about. A few of the older men still talked as before, but these stalwarts dwindled in numbers rapidly as time took its toll. One Saturday evening in 1932, Walter went into the taproom to find that he was the only representative of the old brigade present. He sat down in a corner with his pint and made some remark concerning the past week's work on the land. But the company was not interested. Some had journeyed that afternoon in a charabanc to witness the cup tie some 30 miles away, and most of the others had visited the picture palace in the market town. The merits of the home team's forwards and the sex appeal of some favourite film star were the important topics that evening. Walter could not understand it. Surely they depended on their farms, and must be more interested in their work than in anything else. Besides, as a head shepherd, he had a certain position to maintain in the village, so in a loud voice he started his pet subject once more. "They shut up, old 'un," said a young labourer. "We be finished with that Saturday 12 o'clock, thank God." "Aye, that's right enough, that is," said another. "It's no you, I know thick cut be coming south these time. They Warmington fellas got their tails up smartish." "What were picture like Saturday noon, Henry?" asked another. "Not so bad, you. Thick Linda Crompton's as nice as a bit of goods as ever I see. I wouldn't mind taking Sheever a walk up Ron Castle Rings one evening." "Well, he hadn't likely to get the chance. Yeah. Any of we know how t'other matches went?" Someone produced an evening paper, and for a while football reigned supreme. Walter Noakes could not understand any of it, and he did not want to. He knew it was all wrong. Both farmers and labourers seemed to look on the land as a means to an end. Didn't they realise that the land would resent this treatment, would soon fail in consequence to provide for these tawdry pleasures, and he, of all men, had been insulted and told to shut up? It was time somebody told these fools. Yes, he'd tell them. He started to do so, and was met with a chorus of disapproval, but he would not stop. He stood up, he thumped the table, and screeched his warnings. "Look at your dad," said one, "thee best op it. Come on now, drink up thee beer and go home. We've had enough of thick sort of yap." At first, a few sided with the old man, and said that he had a perfect right to stay. But as he lost his temper more and more, their sympathies faded. "Aye, let him get home," they said. "Damn it, we do want these place for run, not for talking about work." In a few minutes, the old man was shepherded to the door and forced gently outside. When he had recovered from the shock of his indignity, he stood for a moment and gazed around him. A car bearing some young farmers and girls to a dance and a bus laden with villagers off to town passed swiftly by. "They be all alike," he muttered as he set off for home. "Whatever be it coming to." Surely, sympathisers with both sides of the argument must sometimes ask themselves the same question.
Well, that was a nice, pleasant, floral, colourful countryside contrast to a lot of the rest of the show. Thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves' wonderful tones reading A.L. Street's Hedge Trimmings.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Trevor Carter, our resident bard, is here with his latest poem, A Bit of Culture. Hello.
Hello, John. Hello.
What have you got for us?
Well, I'll go this week, in contrast to the seriousness of the rest of the show, this is a good news story that I heard on the news quiz on Sunday. And it's concerning a judge called Judge.
A judge called Judge?
A judge named Judge, so thereby who's known as Judge Judge, and rightfully so. So, just to give you an outline of what it's about, this some guy was sent down for a few years for bashing up a burglar, and Judge reviewed the case and decided it wasn't really an appropriate sentence.
Right.
He said, you know, it's fair enough, really.
Yeah, he's defending his family.
Yeah, you know, it's not. So that's the gist of it. All right.
Sock it to us.
Good Judge. Let's raise a glass to good Judge. He proves that judges sometimes budge to adjust the bad, unjust decision and impose a sensible revision. Most people feel it's a disgrace if someone invades a private space to feed some sordid, selfish need. It's a really, really seedy deed. So when a citizen is thus transgressed, it is likely he won't be impressed. It is likely he'll get aggravated and then become quite animated, and seeking out some satisfaction there could be a rather strong reaction, and if there's not time to work it out he deserves the benefit of the doubt. And when stupid judgments come to pass, people say that the law's become an ass. So let's raise a glass to good Judge who recognises when to budge. He's not a judge to bear a grudge, to vacillate or flap or fudge. So let's hear a cheer for this good judge who judges when it's time to budge.
Thank you very much to Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill.
And can I just mention, this Sunday the 31st at the Port Wall Tavern, tremendous show, only a fiver for an evening of scintillating music, magic, and a bit of satirical wit, and a stunning circus finale.
Wow.
At the Port Wall Tavern. Doors open 7:30, show starts at 8:30, only a fiver.
Good Lord. And in these recession-ridden times, only £5.
Incredible. I don't know how we do it.
Well, it's time once again for our very own Jeff Sparks, who is a Sherpa professor that escaped from the psych ward at Katraz, so I don't know how close I should be sitting to him. Hello, and what's going on in Bristol?
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 3rd of February, and Bellowhead will be performing at the Old Vic in King Street, Bristol. The gig starts at 7:30pm, and tickets range from £5 up to £15, but hurry as they are selling fast. On to Thursday, 4th of February, and Lacuna Coil will be performing with support from Dirty Little Rabbits, who feature Sean Crahan from Slipknot, and also support from Domin at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £15 in advance. Into Friday, 5th of February, and Blackfire will be performing at the Reckless Engineer at Temple Gate, Bristol. The gig starts around 9pm and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Infected Mushroom. This group, originally formed in Israel in 1996, and to date have released 7 albums. This is from their latest album, Legend of the Black Shawarma, and it's a track titled Poquito Mas. Infected Mushroom with Poquito Mas from the album Legend of the Black Shawarma. For more information on them, you can check out www.myspace.com/InfectedMushroomCentral. Keeping with Friday 5th of February, and the Imperials will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Moving into Saturday 6th of February, and Naughtiness, formerly One Step Below, we'll be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 7th of February, James Morton and the Lunatics will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place in Clifton, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
That's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show. Thank you very much to our studio guests, Barbara Raleigh, Tim Elliott and Terry Clements. Terry Clements, the presenter of The Recovery Show about drugs and drug support, is on Bristol Community FM, bcfm.org.uk, and that's 93.2 FM, and his show is on Sunday between 11 and 12. And our show is on straight after that. Thank you to Malcolm Greaves, who read Headstrings by A.L. Street, and features were by Anthony Page, Tony Gosling and Johnny Royden. Thank you to Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and the What's On was by Jeff Sparks. The studio engineers were Johnny Royden, Andy Gordon and Cam, and the producer was Anthea Page. And goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman. Take care. You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectradio.co.uk.